Alrighty, so nature in general and in particular. I'll try to give you a good outline here on the board since the printer was acting up. Nature is the word that we're talking about today. It'll set us up for the rest of the class. The way we're going to study the nature of God flowing into the nature of things is through three pairs of things. So this will form our outline. And these three pairs are creation and providence. Let me write the outline up here. Creation and providence. Secondly, good and evil. Obviously, these are opposing, whereas this is an offshoot of that. And then thirdly, the personal and impersonal. So that's the outline. And the big idea is that everything has a nature, and therefore a perfection and a defection. So this is the basic template. If I forget and erase this, it's just because I need room. But just so you get a visual, the big idea is that everything has a nature. That should not be controversial. Everything has a nature. In other words, everything has a basic way that it is. And therefore, everything has a perfection. In other words, the totality of everything. It's complete. It is what it ought to be. But if that's true, then there's a defection. Okay, so think of those words, perfect and defect. So if a thing is a thing at all, then it has a nature. So every single thing that exists has an objective way that that thing is and therefore ought to be. And that concept, if it's not going off in you right now, it should be a hint, which we'll get to today, to how we get to natural law and what natural law actually is versus what it isn't. This is, I think, one of the most misunderstood ideas in the Reformed community. One of those ideas that if the Reformed are not careful, they'll continue to drive intellectual types back to Rome. Not that that excuses them, but this is something that we have to get right. We have to actually resurrect the classical doctrine of the nature of things and objective thinking. So let's get to this. The first section, creation and providence. The first distinction that Aquinas makes is between the purely spiritual nature and the corporeal nature. I'm not going to make a big deal out of that. He has a good section on creation. It's not very controversial, not much different than Augustine, for example. The highest nature, namely God, caused there to be every other nature, not just spiritual natures like angels, but corporeal natures. And I'm not going to get into angels either, though Aquinas has a lot to say about that. He divides up this idea of creation into three things: creation per se, distinction, and preservation. So God saying, let there be, God separating things in the works of creation, and then finally preservation. What he's going to ultimately mean by that is providence. So that can be found in two sections of Aquinas' writing, his commentary on Lombard's Sentences, and specifically a section on the work of the 6 days of creation. And then his section in the Summa is question 44 on the procession of creatures from God and the first cause of all being. So that's the section to find us in the Summa Theologica is question 44. So what Aquinas does is he divides question 44 into four sections based on the four causes. So let me draw another thing. Yeah, I'll do it just like this. And so if you're familiar with the four main causes, and when we get into intelligent beings, we'll add the instrumental cause. Let's just draw the same map. Nice. And then in this map, the circle is going to represent everything. So there it's anything. Here let's just put everything. And let's specifically mean, forget about the angels for a second here. Let's just mean the physical universe. Okay? So there's the efficient cause. Here we're just going to add one thing. Everything coming back to him. And Aquinas does actually quote from Romans 11:36, for from him and through him and to him, and that's that end cause, are all things. Okay? So let's put a four there, the end cause, because the two and the three are in here, the matter and the form. Material. And let's put the three over here around this circle to represent form, the formal cause. Okay, so that's everything, the whole physical universe. This is how he breaks up the section. He asks the question. There's four articles, and as you look at the articles, you realize, hey, that's the four causes. And the questions are, is God the efficient cause of all things? And then secondly, in what sense was there a material cause? If he creates ex nihilo, so he creates out of nothing, what matter is he using? So you see the dilemma there. Thirdly, in what sense is God his own formal cause if there's nothing else like him? How can he be the formal cause, the idea of everything else? And then fourthly, is God the end cause of all things? So first, to the efficient cause. It's objected, and remember the style of the scholastic method. It starts with the objections. So in this case, it seems that God is not the efficient cause of all things, and it gives its reasons. It'll list out three or four objections, and then what does he do? He says, on the contrary, and he'll quote a scripture, or a church father, or a philosopher, and then he will refute that, and then give the replies to the specific objections. That's the way it's laid out. So I'll summarize these. To the efficient cause, it is objected in a few different ways that whatever is necessary could not be an effect. But since many things are necessary, these cannot proceed from God. So you see the objection. And you say, wait a minute, that's an equivocation on the kind of necessity. You know, there's many necessary things, laws of mathematics, for example. Let's just start with that. And if there's many necessary things, a necessary thing cannot be an effect, therefore those things cannot proceed from God. So he cites Romans 11:36 to the contrary, and then he replies that subsisting being must be one. Therefore, all beings apart from God are not their own being, but are beings by participation. So in other words, it follows from what he's already been proving concerning perfection and simplicity, that when we ascribe something to something and say it's more or less, that derives from the most and the greatest. So even like the laws of mathematics and stuff like that, those things are one. So what he's trying to say is that those are all aspects of one being. He's already proven that about the nature of God in that section on divine simplicity. So there can only be one first cause of all, and all that is necessary is necessarily in him. I'm not going to go into prove that because he's already proven that in the doctrine of God. I'm just summarizing that implies this about creation. So for example, when you see that 2 plus 2 necessarily equals 4, that is either an attribute of God or something in the mind of God, which is then based more on his attributes. So you've got some choices there. When you're looking at something that looks necessary, either that thing is not really necessary, which you can't say about those things, or you have to say, well, it's always existed outside of God, but that would be pluralism. That wouldn't be monotheism anymore. Or it's something in God. Okay, and so Aquinas shows that it has to be something in God. So that's how he answers that. Secondly, to the material cause, it's objected that a nature only produces its like, as is seen from the principle of sufficient reason. But material contains what is accidental, potential, and bodily. Now remember a couple weeks ago when we looked at the simplicity of God, there can't be anything accidental, bodily, or potential in the first cause. So material must have always been what Aristotle called prime matter. That's the objection. He could not have created material, or he couldn't have used material, or something like that. And Aquinas' reply is a little bit dense. He takes you on a whole progression of Greek thought down to Aristotle, but he does it like in two paragraphs. So it can be a really thick section. But his point was that this whole idea is too simple. All being requires explanation, unless it is in pure act. So he's already proven that. And beyond that, by the way, in reading Aquinas, unlike, in one sense, it's a very simple style, because it's a really encyclopedic fashion that I just described. But in another sense, if you didn't read the section before, you really can't just start in section 44. Because it'll constantly frustrate you by this phrase, as has already been proven. And then it'll give you the citation and stuff like, well, if you didn't read that, or if you missed that, then you're not going to know what he's talking about. But beyond that, in the next question, question 45, he shows that the term ex nihilo, or out of nothing, is equivocal in that nothing is not the cause, strictly speaking. When we say that God created ex nihilo, we don't mean that creation came from nothing. We don't mean self-creation. Okay? Nor do we mean that God created for no reason. We mean that he didn't use matter. Matter itself is created. So this preposition, Aquinas says, from, or ex in the Latin, does not designate the material cause, but only order. So in that sense, there wasn't a material cause. He created ex nihilo. There was no material before he created it. Thirdly, to the formal cause, which he calls the exemplary cause here. It's objected that there are many self-existing species. There are exemplars such as man per se, or color per se. In other words, the idea of that thing. Those examples which derive their meaning from these participate in such a species. So particular men participate in man. Particular colors participate in color. Hence, these are the formal cause of these things and not God. And the principle of sufficient reason, besides, is cited here to say that the effects are not like God. Therefore, God cannot be the formal cause. But Thomas responds, on the contrary, the exemplar is the same as the idea. But ideas, according to Augustine, are the master forms which are contained in the divine intelligence. Therefore, the exemplars of things are not outside of God. Now, again, just cite that to say that any historian philosophy that says that Thomas's realism is just this moderate realism in the same way that Aristotle's did, was, and that he didn't agree with Augustine that universals were inside of God, they've obviously not read Aquinas very carefully, because he's consistently saying that. That the form of things, like man, or the form of things like even color, are in God. So, here's something to keep in mind. The fact that we don't personally understand exactly what a particular thing says about God does not change the truth that each thing is in the form of something about God. The idea of something divine is communicated in all created things. Fourthly and finally, to the end cause. It is objected that a motive toward an end implies a need, but God doesn't need anything. Further, it is objected, all things desire their end, but all things do not desire God, for all do not even know Him. Therefore, God is not the end of all things. End quote. So he responds right away, on the contrary, it is said in Proverbs 16:4, the Lord has made all things for Himself. I answer that every agent acts for an end. Otherwise, one thing would not follow more than another from the action of the agent, unless it were by chance. So, Thomas's next words are a little bit cryptic at first, but they're actually going to prove very important for understanding our concept of objective nature here. He says this, and when he does, picture this arrow again. The efficient cause is acting for an end. The efficient cause is always acting for an end. And that immediately, if you weren't here for that week, that might raise some difficulties for you. Like, wait a minute, does that mean it's thinking about its end? It has a desire? Not necessarily. But what he's going to show here, let's fatten this arrow up a little bit in those pictures, and just to show an impress in the thing. So it's acting upon something. Any efficient cause and the thing it's acting upon both have an end. So here's the quote. Now the end of the agent, that's the arrow, that's the actor, the end of the agent, and of the thing acted upon, they both have an end. The end of the agent and the end of the thing acted upon, considered as such, is the same, but in a different way with respect to each. So for the squirrel and the acorn. And so forth. For the impression which the agent endeavors to produce and which the thing acted upon endeavors to receive are one and the same. By the way, the word endeavor, end. We invest in this, the caricature, that these things need to be thinking. But think of the word intend and tend. This tends because it has been tended into. Intend. So think of those words. It's not a language game. Just think about it. We're redefining reality here. We're coming back to the real nature of these words that have been redefined for us. We're getting back to the real meaning of these words. There you go. That'd be a better way to say it. But we have to remember, when it comes to end cause here, and by the way, if you're wondering, what does end cause have to do with nature? I thought we were going to talk about nature today. End cause and how it actually works is going to be crucial to understanding the nature of things down here, especially moral things. So, let's remember how we've already knocked down the straw man version of end cause in the early going. Final causation, or end causation, does not depend upon the consciousness in all of these elements, or these actors, but rather it is rooted in the more immediate and constant reality of inherent tendencies. If rocks tend to break windows when thrown at windows, it does not depend, nor are we saying, that the rock is thinking to itself, must break the window like all my brothers did. Must break the window. We're not saying that. Okay? Inherent tendencies, that things tend toward a definite object, necessitates that there is an intender. For that process cannot go on to infinity either, as Aquinas has already proven. Only the intended tends in. Hence, when Aquinas says that the agent being acted upon also endeavors to receive that same end as that which acts upon it, he means it very literally. There's a reason why there is a particular range of effects when I throw the rock at the window. It doesn't, any of those times, let alone many of those times, turn into a bouquet of flowers when it strikes the window pane. It tends to break it. Why? Because the rock and the velocity in my arm and the window pane all have a particular nature. Okay? When you start to break this down, you start to say, is that really what the modern worldview is disagreeing with? Believe it or not, yes. That's why last night went that way. Believe it or not, yes. Let's draw this out. What about the relationship between chance and final causality? This idea of chance, I think, will start to blow this open a little bit. One Thomist, who I've quoted approvingly, and for the most part I do like his writings, but here is where he's going to show his Catholic cards. Okay, I believe. And this, I don't believe he's understanding Aquinas perfectly here. Edward Fezzer, he allows, in his book on Aquinas, he allows for a range of chance that I don't believe Thomas, as I read him, would have adhered to in his day. And I suspect that this has to do with the later soteriological question that we're going to disagree with even Thomas on. But Fezzer cites the example of a farmer who by chance, and by the way, if you've ever read R.C. Sproul on this subject, on that book, Not a Chance, maybe you'll have a clue already where I'm going. Chance is not a thing. But let's deal with this for a second. He uses the example of a farmer who just by chance stumbled upon some hidden treasure while plowing his field. And so Fezzer says, such a discovery was not in any sense intended. Well, let's come back to that, but you caught it good. Neither by the farmer nor by the person who buried the treasure. I agree with that. Neither by the farmer nor by the person who buried the treasure. And not by nature either, insofar as there was no causal law entailing that treasure will tend to be uncovered when one plows the ground. So there's no natural law either that says that when you plow a field, you tend to get treasure, okay, instead of corn. So there's no nature intending, there's no farmer intending, the person that buried the treasure didn't intend that guy to have it. But that is guilty of begging the question, the fallacy of begging the question, or else the fallacy of equivocation, because he uses the phrase in any sense that you caught it. Such a discovery, he says, was not in any sense intended. Fezzer excludes the theological sense. And notice that whether such a sense remains a mystery to human reason does not affect the sense in which there is a sense. Fezzer recovers himself in the example to show chance still existing within the causal matrix. Fezzer's whole point is that even the things that you call chance exist within. It's not disproving end cause. I agree with Fezzer on that. But I think Fezzer misinterprets Aquinas' use of the word fortuitous. Fezzer's saying, you know, when we see something by chance, that doesn't disprove end cause, because even that rests back on a series of things that really are caused by an end. What Aquinas was saying was stronger. He was saying, what we call fortuitous isn't really. It is to us. Okay? So this is how he ends the paragraph. All the same, Fezzer says, the farmer did intend to plow the ground. There's an end. Someone did intend to bury the treasure. There's another end. And there are all sorts of causal laws operative when the farmer happens fortuitously to uncover treasure. There's an end too. Hence, chance presupposes a background of causal factors. So Fezzer is smuggling rationalism into Aquinas' use of fortuitous when he did not intend that. Chance presupposes a background of causal factors which themselves neither have anything to do with chance, nor can plausibly be accounted for without reference to final causality. I agree. He ends up, so that it would be incoherent to suppose that an appeal to chance might somehow eliminate the need to appeal to final causality. So, in one sense, that's a good save. Fezzer is trying to show that chance occurrences do not disprove end causes in all things. I agree with him. He didn't go far enough. And he misread Aquinas in the process. Why did he do it? Because he was motivated to leave chance in the universe. Why did he do that? We'll see when we get to salvation. Aquinas was more of a Calvinist than Thomas are. He's not consistent, we'll see. But these guys are all running from Reformed theology at the end of the day. But anyway, in his zeal to distance himself from modern evidentialists, it seems that Fezzer has forgotten that chance is not a thing, and therefore cannot be considered as a thing with causal power. In lieu of our knowledge about this or that deeper supernatural cause, we can't just go around calling chance something that we don't know the cause of. Well, the deck was shuffled so fast that I'll just call it chance. Okay, if what you mean by that is, I don't know, the deck of cards moved too fast. Cool, fine, that means you're ignorant. But don't call chance a thing that caused it then. Now to divine providence. How does God order or govern or preserve the world in the thought of Thomas Aquinas? Well, in four articles, in question 22, he answers whether providence is suitably assigned to God, whether everything comes under divine providence, whether divine providence is immediately concerned with all things, whether divine providence imposes any necessity upon things foreseen, which we'll come back to in another section. I'm just going to treat the second article because the first article deals with theology proper and we've already covered it. But the second article faces the objection that not everything comes under divine providence. There's two basic objections to this. One is chance and the other is evil. So, two basic objections to providence and all things. Chance and evil. There were actually like five things there, but they were all kind of derivatives of those. It's objected that providence and chance are irreconcilable, and since chance exists, then at least those things cannot be by providence. Further, a wise provider excludes defect and evil as far as he can from those under whom he has care. But we see many evils existing. Either then God cannot hinder these, or thus is not omnipotent, or else he does not have care for everything. Man, that's word for word David Hume's most famous formulation of the problem of evil. It's almost like David Hume is plagiarizing Thomas Aquinas as much as Joseph Smith was plagiarizing the King James. So it doesn't seem like David Hume is so original after all. Aquinas was very aware of that full formulation of the problem of evil. All right. Well, let's see how Thomas deals with the objections of chance and evil. As far as chance, he's going to have none of it. Aquinas compares that which is causal to that which is fortuitous. But he is very quick, unlike Fezzer, he's very quick to point out that what we call both of these, chance or cause, is according to our knowledge of the order of causes. For example, wood for burning that has been dampened instead of being ignited. The fact that we're surprised or bewildered that it didn't fulfill its purpose is what we mean by fortuitous. But it is not the case that there was no definite end cause any more than it could be the case that there was no cause at all. Rain. Okay, that's an easy example, but same principle. Now, as far as evil is concerned, one can only call a thing evil in relation to good. And so if there's a universal good served by a particular evil, there's no contradiction. So Aquinas, in a very short amount of time, takes the whole problem of evil in a couple of paragraphs. Number one, you have to know good for there to be evil. That cuts out the problem of evil and reduces it to the problem of saying evil, as I call it. And then he goes on to the second point. So if there's a universal good that is served by a particular evil, there's no contradiction. Like, for example, I might say, comparatively, it would be evil for me to get up right now in the middle of the night, but in order to serve the greater purpose of defending my family, I'll do it. Okay? And so if you put it on that micro level, nobody has any problem understanding that. But it's the same principle on the macro level. So he says, corruption and defects in natural things are said to be contrary to some particular nature. Like for me sleeping is in contradiction to me getting up right now. Yet they are in keeping with the plan of universal nature, since the defect in one thing yields to the good of another. or even to the universal good. For the corruption of one is the generation of another, by which means the species is conserved. All right, so that's pretty much his reasoning there. Good and evil. Good and evil, our second point. Basically, and this is, you know, basically the end to his answering the objection too, but what is good in examples of things is only called good because there's an idea. There's a form of goodness. This is just Plato 101 here. For Aristotle and Aquinas, there is what some modern theorists call an ontology of morals. In other words, moral things are things, too. Moral things are not non-things. Morality is not nothing, it's something. It's either something or nothing. And if it's something, then it's a thing with a nature. So Aristotle and Aquinas and all classical thinkers treated morality, good and evil, ontologically. Those crazy, crazy classicalists. For example, the Thomist does not speak of moral values, but of the objective good. You say, what's the difference? Let's call this the good. It's either something or nothing. If it's something, then it creates the moral universe in all of its dimensions. Let's, inside of the circle of the good, put two persons. You could put 7 billion if you wanted to, but we don't have enough room on the chalkboard. So let's just put two. And then inside here, we're going to put the word value coming from him, and we'll put the word value coming from him. Classicalists spoke of the good, not of moral value. Why? Because one is objective, standing over all, the other is subjective, coming from any or all. To speak of values, in other words, begs the very question in the controversy. Is morality objective or is it subjective? But given the real essence of good, moral judgments such as that is good, that is bad, that's better, that's best, and that's the worst, those follow of logical necessity. If there is a good that stands over all, then those words are meaningful. If they're not, then they're not. And the rational mind will see that the supreme question here is whether or not there is such an objective good. But since Thomas has already demonstrated that there must be, and that was question 5 or 6 in the Doctrine of God on the goodness of God and goodness in general, that there would be no motion, indeed there would be nothing in existence if there was not, therefore we cannot go back into irrationality so as to avoid one of reality's irresistible deductions, that there is a good and evil, and therefore there is a right and wrong, and these are objective. So, where's this going? Now we're getting back into nature. Now the ethical dimension of natural law is natural, here's why we call it natural, precisely because of the convergence of a couple of very objective things. There's an objective nature of good and evil, there's an objective nature of human beings, and there is an objective nature of the spheres of society in which these moral agents interact. So, everything on this board is objective. There is a good. There is a human nature, a rational moral agent. Let's call it the moral actor. And there is a, let's call it a moral stage. Social spheres, individuals together. The last 2 weeks of our Law of God and the City of Man class have divided the image of God into that, the individual and the community. But the point is that all three of these things, the good, the moral actor, and the moral stage, are all objective things. If that's not factored into your social theory is irrational, which is why libertarianism is an irrational worldview. It doesn't factor in the nature of those things as natures. There's a convergence of natures that cannot be reduced to the subjective value-making mechanisms of individuals. Nothing in there arises from the individual. Nothing in there arises from the individual. If it did, it would be subjective and blathering, relativistic, feely, squishy nonsense, which is what I think about Ayn Rand. And frankly, it's what I think about most of the people, unfortunately, in the Ron Paul movement. Okay? There's a worldview that ignores the objectivity of those things, in spite of the ironic fact that they call themselves objectivists. These are things with natures that press in on us. They are real independent of us. We do not make them what we want. Now, contemporary philosophers, I don't want to pick just on Ayn Rand, contemporary philosophers of all stripes tend to think the exact other way around. They claim that Thomistic moral essentialism, that's their word, by the way, for medieval realism. They don't want to call it realism because they want to think of it as dragons and elves and stuff. And so they'll call it essentialism, which does play on another word that has something to do with this, and that is that Thomas and all those classicalists, and really you could say this about Plato, Aristotle, Augustine, or Aquinas, they believe that there's an essence to things. In other words, that there is a way that everything is, that it doesn't depend on your perspective, that there's one size fits all for everything. Yes, I think we can admit to believing that. There is a way that everything is. But moral essentialism, they say, ignores what's called the fact-value distinction. So the great crime in social theory and moral philosophy that essentialism makes is that we ignore what's called the fact-value distinction. And another way to say that is the is-ought distinction. How do we do that? And what is it? Well, we've already learned from Augustine that the is versus the ought distinction is very different in a world where you assume supernature. What the fact-value distinction comes to mean in naturalism, in the modern worldview, is that nature equals what is. Why does nature equal what is? Because nature, that second definition of it, is all there is. All there ever was, all there is, all that there ever will be. Carl Sagan? That's naturalism. Nature is all there is. And so is equals nature, namely the physical universe. Such that there is not an ought in the objective world, nature being all there is. You see the dilemma? The first dilemma of the fact-value distinction is that nature is all there is. So let's draw a circle and let's put the word is, signifying everything that is. That is the object. What is objective? What is real? Now, can I go outside of that? No, because there is nothing outside of what is. So where will I get what ought? Not in that circle, which immediately creates two problems. You're guilty of circular reasoning. You're assuming that up front. And then secondly, you have absolutely cut out the ought, which is why naturalism does lead to nihilism. So for Nietzsche, for example, to say that whatever is right would have been tantamount to some kind of brute, cold acceptance of the power of whatever's winning in history. So when modern man hears is and ought are the same, all they hear is naturalism, because they've assumed naturalism up front. But when Augustine would say that, he meant something very different. Because a Christian has an infinitely bigger is to appeal to. If things are not as they ought to be, we can go outside of the system to the much more infinite reality of the way things are. We have a higher is. That's a good way to say it. An infinite is versus a finite is. And that's the only way that ought makes any sense. If you're a naturalist, what sense does the term ought even have? This ought to be otherwise. There's no such thing as otherwise. But if you're a theist, you have an infinite is to draw back on. And so these, and they're called sometimes neo-Humeans, appropriately, I think, because Hume started to make some of the biggest early mistakes. But they call this the naturalistic fallacy. So if you violate, either through neglect or you just steamroll right through it, the fact-value distinction, you are guilty of committing the naturalistic fallacy. What is the naturalistic fallacy? It is neglecting the is-ought distinction. You cannot rest the ought on the is. You cannot have objective moral value. So out of this comes the common speech that you'll hear, for example, on the first day of a science class, You'll hear the professor tell all the students, oh no, scientists are not godless people. There's many scientists that have religious values and stuff like that. But see, science, they just operate in two different spheres of reality. Science is what looks at the world. What is? Religion is very valuable. Religion deals with values and pink unicorns. And they don't say pink unicorns, but that's what they meant. They patted all the religious people on the head and said, no, we're not making fun of your little pink unicorns. This won't touch that because it's not real. It's just gas. Not even brain gas. It's just regular gas. It's feely gas. We're not going to touch your feely gas. We're not going to touch your feely gas. And here's the thing. The naturalist is in agreement with that pietist that that's the only place you can get off. It's still important to you. But here's the thing. These guys are guilty of this very thing. It's why it's appropriately called the naturalistic fallacy. For that very reason. But they seem oblivious to the fact that the egg is completely on their face. They're guilty of circular reasoning here. They are assuming in their premise what they seek to conclude, namely that nature is all there is. But that begs the question, the very question that is at controversy, whether or not there is an objective good. Now, in this nature, or natural law, whole lingo, there's a term that, if you had your notes, you'd have it. It's called basic good. You'll see this in the arguments of Robert George, for example, in the question over same-sex marriage, and we are going there in the course of the rest of this class, natural law. But a basic good, just doing some grammar up front here, a basic good is just a good that is self-evident and behind all other goods. So we're talking about a human good here. Now, this would apply to the chief end of personal beings or impersonal beings. But if the end of anything entails a standard of goodness, this is what we call a basic good instead of a subordinate good. You're pursuing this thing as an end in itself. It's self-evident that this is good. So of the personal, Thomas says, quote, all those things to which man has a natural inclination. Stop. Well, that's bad things too. Okay, then you're still stuck on the word nature. Nature, in its primary sense, is only good all the time. You're talking about fallen nature. Remember the first meaning of the word nature, the characteristics of a thing. So you have to modify that to be evil. You have to say fallen nature or corrupt nature or something like that, distorted nature. Okay? But nature essentially is good, or else you're back to Gnosticism, or you're saying that God is bad, or Manichaeanism, or some other worldview. Okay? So Thomas says, all those things to which man has a natural inclination are naturally apprehended by reason as being good, and consequently as objects of pursuit, and their contraries as evil and objects of avoidance. So what did he say? We have ends, we move toward those ends, we have chief ends and subordinate ends. Subordinate ends are those ends that we seek for the good of something greater. Ultimate ends, or chief ends, are the goods for the sake of which you can't go any further. We're not pursuing them as a means to something else, but as an end in themselves. So that is a basic human good, and that's what we want to show. Now, this is going to be important. This phrase, basic good, is going to be important in the defense of natural law being proposed today by the Princeton legal scholar and Catholic, Robert George. It is said by Fezzer, he has a criticism for this new natural law theory, that there's an attempt to divorce the argument from that ontology of morals that we just talked about, where the nature of moral things is metaphysical first. So, I don't know if this is true. I've read one book of George, and I'm starting the second one on a defense of natural law. I'm not sure if he's actually guilty of this, but Fezzer says he is, so I will keep my eye open for it. The new natural law theory, and man, if they're trying to get away from Aquinas even a little bit, then it's not a step in the right direction, because we're trying to recover natural law. But you have this guy, Robert George at Princeton, who lectures at Harvard and elsewhere, and he'll defend not only Catholics but evangelicals in our view of... unfortunately, he can't defend our view of natural law because evangelicals have rejected natural law, but still want to argue for pro-life and against same-sex marriage. You need natural law if you want to argue against the pro-choice position or against same-sex marriage. So pay attention to this guy, Robert George. I think he has a good argument. But Fezzer is saying that the new natural law theory is actually trying to argue for natural law on the basis of basic goods, but apart from a metaphysical good first. Not just apart from Scripture, which that's why I would fault Aquinas and that tradition for not arguing natural law from Scripture. That allowed some of the misunderstandings that the Reform have had. But now they're taking even a step further in arguing for a basic good apart from the good. Okay, that would be a huge mistake. So I will have my antennas up when I read Robert George. Last section, the personal and the impersonal. I'm going to give you three examples, and these three examples are going to cement everything we mean. And I'm so glad I left that on the board now. The nature of anything in our big idea, therefore it has a perfection and a defection. These three examples will cement forever in your mind, I guarantee you, what really is meant by natural law. Okay, let's start with an animate but impersonal creature, the squirrel. I don't know why Fezzer used the example of a squirrel, but it's fine. So he says, a squirrel who likes to scamper up trees and gather nuts for the winter, or whatever, is going to be a more perfect approximation of the squirrel's essence than one which, through habituation or genetic defect, prefers to eat toothpaste spread on Ritz crackers and to lay out spread eagled on the freeway. So, you see the distinction. A squirrel who likes to gather nuts for the winter is going to be a more perfect approximation of the essence of squirrel than one which, through habituation or genetic defect, prefers to eat toothpaste spread on Ritz crackers and to lay out spread eagle on the freeway. Silly example, right? But do you see what he's saying? There's a perfection of squirrelness. There's an essence of it. There's a type. And then there's a, what you might even call a shadow. Type versus shadow. Here he's meaning type like Plato did. An archetype, a blueprint, an essence. Let's use a second example. He cites the example of a triangle. It is the objective essence of a triangle to have three straight sides. When we see a triangle drawn freehand and one drawn on the back of a seat of a moving bus, neither will conform perfectly to essence. They will both be approximations, but one will be nearer to the perfect than the other. He says this judgment would be completely objective. It would be silly to suggest that it reflects nothing more than a subjective preference for triangles with angles adding up to 180 degrees. That is not a subjective preference. That is triangularity. That is what a triangle is. Thirdly, let's mix it up a little bit by showing you something else about this in the third example of a rock. We would never call a rock blind, though we would put a rock in a class of non-seeing things. We wouldn't blame a rock for not seeing. This is no defect because the perfection of a rock is not sight. So we don't call rocks blind. We just recognize that they're not seeing things. Now, on the other hand, the perfection of the eye is visible sight, even as the perfection of the intellect is invisible sight, or what we might call insight. And thus the eye and the mind are blameworthy to the degree that they do not see what they ought to see. Blindness and ignorance are the defects in that which is perfected by seeing. Now let's draw a circle around all this, bring it together, and show you what we're getting at. In summary, of squirrels, triangles, and rocks, we can form what we called in those logic classes a categorical type A statement. A universal affirmative about squirrels, triangles, and rocks. And a universal affirmative would say all of something. So we'd say all squirrels, and then the predicate, all triangles, and then the predicate, all rocks, and then the predicate. That is a universal affirmative statement about squirrels, triangles, and rocks. So, all squirrels store food. All triangles have three straight lines. All rocks are formed gradually. These represent norms. Let's put that word up there. Norms. From which we get the word normal. It's a moral word, but it's also a logical word. It's an ontological word. So, let's take, if we were to take, the complete contradictory statement. And remember in logic, you had the square of opposition. And we saw that these statements stand into a contradictory relationship to each other. So if I want to say all something is something, the only thing I would need to so to contradict it would be to say that some of that thing is not that thing. Okay? If just one counterexample is produced, then it would contradict that statement. And so people look at this and say, aha, that is the flaw in natural law theory. So for example, if I show some squirrel did not store its food, some triangle did not have straight lines, some rock was not formed by a gradual process, in other words, some sexual orientation is not so oriented. Do you get the connection? It would not actually constitute a defeater for the norm. Contrary to those intoxicated with modern logic as something that supposedly emancipates us from Aristotle, Type A universal affirmative statements do not say, for instance, for everything that is a squirrel, it always stores its food. Because that only comes to mean, for everything that is a squirrel, it always got to store its food. Which comes to mean, among other things, that no squirrel has ever been run over in the road by a truck on his way to the acorn. That is what we call a straw man. And it doesn't take too much imagination to see how this plays out in the ethical realm. The counterexample, especially as you add more and more counterexamples, is brought out to show that the norm is not universal after all, and therefore it is not an objective norm after all. Apparently, enough jittery-handed geometers can counterexample the triangle right out of existence. If you really thought that a counterexample in time and space to this category would contradict the norm, then there would be no norms. But if there were no norms, there would be no nothings. Because then nothing would have a nature. Okay? In our logic classes, that even the kids are starting to see this about the objection to these universal statements. Modern logic, oftentimes, if they don't understand what they're saying, will say that these are not actually about things. Only particular things are about things. Some bear. But the moment you say all bears are brown, you're not actually talking about anything anymore. Okay? It's called the existential fallacy in their delusional minds. But at any rate, as Spezer notes about this, and he uses the letters S and F, and he's talking about squirrels. I'm not sure why he put F, but just put a P for subject and predicate. So all S is P. All squirrels store nuts. Let's just go with that one. Oh, I think he goes cats and legs. Cats have four legs. If a particular S happens not to be F, if, for example, a certain cat is missing a leg, that does not show that S's are not F after all, but rather that this particular S is a defective instance of an S. So, if a cat loses its leg, it does not prove that cats are not four-legged beasts. It proves that that cat is a defective cat. What follows from Aquinas' fifth way in the ordering mind and the end cause is all this stuff. That all of reality is driven to an end. All of reality is driven to a perfection. So that a defection is no proof against it, it is a proof of it. The personal explains even that which is personal. That's why Thomas referred to the end cause as the cause of causes. So, last section. What do we really think about the relationship between the nature of things and the most ultimate person, namely the person of God? Let's erase this board really quickly and draw one more board, because this is the debate ever since after Aquinas, and especially the guy who started it was William of Ockham. A lot of bad ideas came from William of Ockham, and even bewildered and bewitched the reformers to a certain extent. What's the relationship between the nature of things and the personal God? And when we say that God is personal, one of the attributes we mean by that has to surely be His will. That He does as He pleases. I can think of a verse for that. He does as He pleases. He has a mind, too. But let's just focus on His freedom to do certain things. And as we've already said, everything has a nature. So if He's doing things, these things have a nature. Now, what do these two things have in common with each other? How are they at odds? Well, what we find in the debate over nature in the centuries after Aquinas is that one side tends to pit objective nature against divine will, and they prefer objective nature, and the other side, vice versa. They prefer the divine will over an objective nature. And hence, both sides see objectivism and voluntarism in an irreconcilable tension. Objectivism, namely, that everything is an object outside of our minds, that everything has a nature, and that has tended to be the conservative Catholic position, versus the position that William of Ockham held, and I believe the best Reformed thinkers did, until the last 100 years, as they've embraced perspectivalism, which is just relativism. And with it, in this debate, they have preferred voluntarism, so named because it is of the will, voluntary. Now, why in the world would these two things be pit against each other? Well, the idea is that if God creates everything by its nature, and if couldn't have created them any other way, then those things would seem to be necessary, just as necessary, if not more necessary, than God. But God has a free will. So when God... And they don't even bring that in. Okay? So what's happening is you're pitting two things that are necessarily true against each other. Both sides would have done better to step back and ask, wait a minute, does an objective nature to things really conflict with God's freedom to do as He wills with those same things? Now, Fezzer rightly criticizes voluntarism in its switching the order of will and intellect in God. In other words, placing what God does over what God knows. Now, Edwards defined the will as the mind choosing. But if the mind knows what the nature of a thing is and creates it according to that nature, one of the reasons that we can have science as well as logic and morality is because the nature of things is fixed. It is what it is. It's objective. But then God's not free to make it otherwise. Well, they should have stepped back from that. Fezzer at least recognizes this, that this switches the order of will and intellect. God could not have freely chosen to do what He did and not do otherwise if He had to do it according to what is true. But one detects in Fezzer a mistake on the opposite side. An absolute necessary link between Ockham's voluntarism and all Reformed theology. Because on the other hand, evangelicals like Greg Thornberry, in a recent book about recovering classical evangelicalism, evangelicals are concerned, the ones that think at all, so just imagine a small pie chart, they're concerned that if God makes everything according to nature, then He could not have created any of those things otherwise, which seems to imply that He's not free. But let me ask everybody a question here. When God knows what a thing ought to be and looks at a nature, when God knows and therefore does, why does this not restrict His freedom? Because when He looks at a nature, He's not looking at the created nature. He's looking at His own nature and sees that it is good. So in Genesis 1, when you read, it is good, it is good, it is good, it is good, God is looking in a mirror, not at those things and saying, whoa, that turned out better than I thought. He sees Himself. If God, according to His own nature, knows and then does, then He's creating according to the necessity of His own nature and not according to the necessity of a nature that does not exist yet. So, this is pretty disappointing. This irrational insistence, if you're wondering why it matters, will unnecessarily continue to turn people away from Reformed theology and toward Rome. And what's going to happen, much like the fascist measures in Europe to suppress Islamic populations, because they didn't deal with this and they started thinking unmasculinely 100 years ago and now it's coming home to roost, what's going to happen is that in America, as more and more secularism invades more and more society, is that desperate measures will have to be taken by thinkers in the church. And one of the easiest ways out will be to go to whoever's at least thinking. And you're going to have more and more people go back to Rome. So, unless, of course, they continue to select popes that are complete Marxists and they go down the same path themselves. But what I'm saying is this matters. Okay? So, questions or comments?